think some of the biggest takeaways is that aiming to remove bias and aiming to center equity does not mean compromising on what the product looks like. Instead, doing those things actually makes your product better and builds more trust.
Welcome to the Regulating AI Podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI Podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological revolution. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives. We've had industry leaders, to government officials, to advocacy group leaders. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create a practical and fair legislation. I'm very excited and honored to have Professor Rashaun Ray with us today. Dr. Ray is a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland. As the founding executive director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research, Ray has helped develop a virtual reality training program for law enforcement and led implicit bias trainings with thousands of police officers, military personnel, and employees at companies and organizations. I invited him on this show as it is very important to get many different perspectives towards framing AI legislation. And we absolutely need to get the perspective from an expert in bias, especially with police and military and its impact on AI regulations. Welcome, Rashaun. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited about this important conversation.
Rashaun, as I mentioned, our audience is global, members of Congress, staff, think tanks, industry. Can you please tell them a little bit about yourself and your very important work?
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, one of my roles is being a professor at the University of Maryland, where I've been for over a decade in the Department of Sociology. And you mentioned my work on policing and virtual reality, which we'll get into a lot. I've also had the opportunity to be a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where I've taken a lot of the research that I've done and actually aim to scale it up to provide policy prescriptions and solutions that are impacting not only people in the United States, but people around the world. My most recent role is with the American Institutes for Research, helping to lead its equity initiative, which is an over $100 million fund to address systemic inequality in local communities. So all of my research pretty much focuses on racial and social inequality. And how I ended up getting to policing and technology and virtual reality is really a torrid path of following research outcomes. While I was primarily concerned with what was happening in local communities, centered with family structure, centered with health outcomes, and also centered with upper mobility through education, and started recognizing the ways that individuals in local communities were not only policed potentially by law enforcement, but even surveilled by some of their own neighbors. And that led me to start looking at policing and surveillance and how that impacts health outcomes. And then what I started realizing is there was a huge gap in people who study policing, but they actually don't interact with law enforcement. And as a person who comes from a law enforcement and military family, I found that a bit surprising and off-putting. So I wanted to make sure that we are working directly with the individuals who hold oftentimes the most ability and the most power to impact us every day, which includes law enforcement. And that led to us eventually developing this virtual reality training program that we'll be talking about.
Rashaun, you've talked a lot about some very important topics, and we're going to really dive deep into it. But as maybe a little bit of a techie junkie, recently there have been some tremendous advances. You've just seen Apple just announce its new product. Meta has now, it seems like, game on as far as virtual reality is concerned. Does that excite you? Does it help with what you're trying to do? Because the immersive experience is a lot more with some of these products, right?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, it does excite me. I think that oftentimes more competition can create better products. I know Meta in particular has been out in front in a lot of ways, from not only the Oculus glasses, which Brendan Irby was actually a student at the University of Maryland when he first started to develop the Oculus glasses, but also the Ray-Ban and the Ray-Ban Stories, which are essentially sunglasses or glasses that people can actually have on and they can record things. I mean, the advancements in technology that I've seen from these companies, from working with Google, from working with Meta, from being in correspondences with Amazon, people kind of have no idea what's coming. And for me, it's exciting. The biggest thing that I always talk about with these companies, though, is the importance of how we think about who is sitting at the table when these decisions are being made, how we think about how these products are going to be dispersed through local communities, and whether or not local communities fundamentally understand what's coming and can play a role in what is ultimately in their backyard. But as far as me, I think all of the technology is super exciting. And I always think about how can we take a product and actually use it for social good? And that's part of what we aim to do with our virtual reality training program for police.
Roshan, final question on this. Are companies, whether it's Apple, Meta, et cetera, are they open to collaborating on what is very, very important work that you're doing? Obviously, they have big markets for gaming and all those other things, but what you're talking about might now not have the ROI for gaming, but it has a way more ROI from a social standpoint. Are they open to some of these things?
I think the companies are open. I think we saw during the pandemic, particularly on investment in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. But even since then, I think a lot of their work is now housed in their policy areas and their policy shops and thinking about legislation and thinking about equitable legislation and how we think about randomized control trials, how we think about beta and alpha products and being ready to go about. So I do see that they are thinking consciously of these particular issues. And of course, that becomes very, very important because the return on investment is one of the big things that they think about. But we should also be thinking about equity and ensuring that these companies are leading the way. And I found that I think they do a much better job than people think they do.
That's great to hear. Roshan, how does your work in using virtual reality for implicit bias align with the goal of democratizing AI? Can you tell our audience a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So what we did, probably going back 7 or 8 years ago, I developed an implicit bias, really a diversity training program for companies, for universities, for organizations like law enforcement. And what I started noticing was that we really didn't have an evaluation tool by which to know the impact that had been done. And as a researcher, that's extremely important. It's not about checking a box. It's whether or not we actually see attitudinal and behavioral change. That then led me to start looking at police training. And what I noticed with police training were a couple of things. First was that they were overwhelmingly training in what I found to be archaic technological settings. For example, if people grew up or were coming of age in the 80s and they played Nintendo and they played Duck Hunt, that was what law enforcement was still using, which I just found fascinating in the years that we were in. I said, there's no way that this is looking realistic, that someone is sitting at a computer and punching a button and seeing as though how a person is responding to a screen. And so we wanted to develop an upgrade for that. The big thing that we did was we aimed to focus on social interactions. As a sociologist, I focus on what's normative and not extremes, which was the second part of what I noticed with law enforcement. Law enforcement typically trains to the extreme, which can be okay when we start talking about over time, the normalization of mass shootings to something happening where there's a hostage situation. Them training for the extremes can prevent mass violence. We get that. But on a regular basis, oftentimes they're interacting with someone at a traffic stop or they are interacting with someone in public. So we created these social interactions that law enforcement encounters every single day. Traffic stop, suspicious person at a bus stop, a mental health call, a domestic violence call, a robbery at a store. And then we varied the race and gender of the person that they encountered, so that we will be able to discern from a research standpoint that if an officer or a group of officers responded differently, that it was primarily due to the race and gender of the person or the setting and not necessarily another factor that people talk about. So part of the background of this was that we collaborated with computer scientists, we collaborated with engineers, and we put everybody in a room and we took our strengths and we came up with a tool that allows us to do this. Because the third thing about this, oftentimes the advances in technology and law enforcement are housed in large police departments. The smaller to mid-sized departments are the ones that are left out. There are over 18,000 police departments in the US. most of them are relatively small. They don't look like NYPD or a large city. Instead, they kind of look like in the heat of the night. It's 10 to 20 to 50 police officers in a particular department. And we wanted to develop a tool that was mobile, that they could set up in a relatively small space that was relatively affordable, where they could be able to access advances in technology and not necessarily be behind the curve.
Rashaan, was there resistance from them in terms of applying this technology? Tell our users, what was your experience? Because it must not have been that easy saying, hey, here, I've got something for you to try. So tell our users, listeners, a little bit about that.
A lot of the resistance, the way that I always think about it, is rational. There was a perception that as researchers, we'd be collecting data and would show that they're biased. And then if there was an incident in the real world, that they would then go out and be held accountable for that. And part of that was just the realism by which we brought to the virtual reality space. When people put on virtual reality goggles, they're immersed into a virtual world, and an algorithm is responding to the officers in real time. That's dictated by what they say, how strongly they say it, and their distance from the VR character. So there was a lot of resistance. There were some police departments who simply did not want to participate. There were some police officers who did not want to participate. And so we had to figure out strategies by which to start working with them. And I think still to this day, there are a lot of barriers, but at the Lab for Applied Social Science Research, we were much more successful than other places. And what we realized is that we could start incentivizing police departments and police officers to participate. Now, people here incentivizing, what do we mean by that? These law enforcement officers are subject matter experts. They know a whole lot more than most people do about how to interact with someone. And then we also realized that within police departments, there were a lack of resources centered around certain types of trainings, centered around community policing, and especially centered around officer mental health. So we were able to provide some grant funding for police departments to participate. And then in exchange, the grant funding went toward these underserved programs that were going on. But yeah, I mean, make no mistake, we could spend all our time talking about the difficulties that we had. And I think for people who have started up companies or done something innovative, they've always faced hurdles, and the people who've been able to overcome it are the ones who are able to tell the stories about what's going on. I mentioned earlier about my law enforcement military family. I lean on that a lot. My great uncle was the first Black chief of police in my hometown. I have another uncle who's a police officer. His son, my first cousin, is a police officer. My granddad served in two wars, Purple Heart, Bronze Star, Presidential Commendation. My mom got into West Point as a Black woman in the 70s, in the late 70s. So telling that story and that history would help me to connect with police officers that I understand and I empathize with them. And then we had a really diverse team of people. What I realized is that based on just my own identities and representation, I didn't always have to be the person out front to communicate with people. There were other people on our team who were part of that. And I think the diversity of our team across race and gender and ethnicity was extremely important for us connecting with law enforcement, for them seeing that we have their best interests at heart and that we just want to move forward in an equitable way.
Well, that's very helpful to know. Rashaan, how do we get the public engaged when it comes to some of these applications, implicit bias training, especially when it comes to AI? Do you see a role for community input in shaping some of these policies?
Most definitely. I think that community input is essential. That hasn't happened enough. I think what it should look like is whenever there's some new technology to be deployed, let's go to San Diego, for example, where San Diego is claiming to be the first kind of smart, fully smart, functional technological city. There are a lot of products that are surveilling people from the sky to the ground that the public may or may not be aware of. There need to be just homegrown community meetings. There needs to be information disseminated on social media. And then there need to be opportunities to get before lawmakers who are allowing this to come in. I think one major issue is on the communication front with the community so that they are aware of what's going on. And I don't think that's happening enough. It's definitely not happening enough on the sampling side. That even before we get to the deployment of technology, the technology needs to be tested to ensure that the algorithm that's embedded within the technology is not biased. And one thing I know is that if the technology is not tested in a diverse way, you will get biased towards one side. For example, when we were priming the algorithm in terms of interacting with law enforcement, we had to ensure that we had a diverse group of police officers across the country, across age, experience, gender, race, and rank. Why was that important? Because if you're only selecting officers from the East Coast. Well, one thing I know, being a Southerner, is that on the East Coast, you might could cuss at a police officer and they don't think twice about it. But you cuss in the South, you cuss in Arkansas, you cuss in Tennessee, they're going to be upset and they're going to react differently. And so now the algorithm is going to be primed that way. But the other issue that happens with technology is oftentimes these technologies are being tested on individuals who ultimately are not going to utilize them. So it was important to include police officers in what we do rather than, say, just having students or having people who you're just bringing in to test the technology. And I think that tech companies are starting to realize that, that they have a standard to raise up to. And it's important to educate the community about what their expectations should be for this technology. And then finally, I think the community needs to ask what they're going to get for it. Are they simply going to be surveilled more, or are they going to actually get something that's going to help keep their community safer, that's going to bring more resources to their community, it's going to bring more jobs, and ultimately make their community a better place to live?
From a community standpoint, we understand that they absolutely, I agree with you, and there's a lot more going on in terms of that. But in terms of democratizing AI, how can legislation ensure that all law enforcement agencies, regardless, as you mentioned, there are some, everything is not NYPD or LAPD, size or budget, they have access to effective VR training for implicit bias? Because this is a very critical issue.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think the first thing is DEI is essential. It's one of those topics that has been weaponized in a lot of different ways. Being in the spaces that I've been in, it's always been around. It's about inclusion. It's about all the steps. Are people sitting at the table? Are they treated the same? Are they allowed to get to the same place based on their history? And then are they included in decision making? It's similar to what Shirley Chisholm and John Lewis have always said. What Shirley Chisholm would say, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. John Lewis would say, don't just put me at the table. Allow me to actually see what's being prepared and participate in that process, rather than you just serving me up a meal that I don't get the chance to partake in. And Bill Parcells, as a football fan, he would say, if you want me to cook, you got to let me pick the groceries. All of these analogies are important about how we think about DEI. And so it's imperative, because oftentimes the technology is being deployed in a way that's not equitable. For example, we know that there have been facial recognition software programs that have done a horrible job and being able to predict people's faces. It's led to people who did not commit a crime being arrested and being incarcerated and being convicted of crimes. It's also allowed, then that means people who ultimately did the crime, oftentimes they got away. So we need to be clear about that. There was facial recognition software that was just misclassifying certain groups of people, say like Black women, because there weren't enough in the sample by which to even start with to be able to read their face, their hair, different sorts of body movements. And then one of the best studies I think about is a study that couldn't tell the difference between, or the technology that couldn't tell the difference between criminals, politicians, and members of the Patriots. And these are not some of the same people. I mean, it should have been able to tell the difference there. So we see how that plays out. I think part of thinking about this then is we have to rely on academic standards. If I'm publishing an article, and I've published a lot of them, there's a certain statistical threshold that has to take place that lawmakers should enforce. We don't expect all lawmakers to know technology like we do, or know about algorithms or AI like we do, but we do expect for them to know how to gather the information and how to get experts to the table. The other thing I think that lawmakers really have to rely on the AI Bill of Rights, which was developed in large part by the leadership of Dr. Alondra Nelson, who was sitting in the White House Technology Council. And I think that's something that also has to happen. There's been some bipartisan algorithmic bias acts that are extremely important to come into play about the thresholds around the confidence intervals in terms of how we think about the success or the viability of this technology. And then finally, we need to assure that, say, if we're talking about law enforcement, that if this technology is going to be used, that it is not the end all be all on how decisions are being made about people being arrested or even being incarcerated, because we know that algorithms are also used as a way to determine risk and to determine who should be let out on parole, who should be held on bond, and so forth and so on. And the unfortunate reality is that if tech companies continue to look the way they look demographically, that our algorithms will continue to simply replicate the inequality that exists in society instead of being something that can be so much better for society. And I think that's where we're trying to get to.
Roshan, you raised some important points that I want to just follow up and before I forget some of them. So one thing is you talked about the tech companies and you know how they are training a lot of this data. It's basically what's on the internet, et cetera. And you saw recently what has happened with Google release product that has come out, et cetera. The one question would be, and you touched on this, what suggestions and do you have for some of these tech companies who are training these data? That's question number one. And then I have one more about the legislation, the algorithmic bias legislation, the bill that you talked about. So if you can just address what can tech companies do? Because they are listening to you here right now.
I think it's two sides for companies. On one hand, it's who's actually developing the products. And of course, they talk about a pipeline issue. Yeah, but see, there are content creators and people who are creating algorithms every single day who may not have degrees from where we have degrees from, but they are content experts and they are experts in this area. Identify them, find them through your networks and include them in the process. They are people who can actually help on the side of developing the products. On the other side is who is actually on the side of who is being tested, who the products are actually being tested on. We need to ensure that there is diversity in a host of ways to ensure that when the technology is applied, that it is being applied in similar ways for different groups of people, particularly in a global context. And I think that becomes extremely important. And I think centering those two things, I'll say that I've been impressed in particular with Meta in terms of their approach to this on their policy unit, in terms of approaching it in this way and trying to have a very diverse group of people at the table to help inform some of these decisions as they go forward.
So two points you made for our listeners is one is when you're creating it, have a diverse group right there who can help with the content. And when you're deploying it also, make sure you get the voices of a diverse community that is doing that. But you also touched on a point that has come up by many listeners is make sure you keep a global perspective because, Roshan, this should not, a lot of our listeners from overseas have said this should not just become an American English thing because the rest of the world is not just English. There's cultural, there is history out there. So you touched on some three very important points for our listeners in the tech industry. Roshan, you also talked about this algorithmic bias bill. We are in an election year, and I'm not looking for you to make predictions, but there are certain things, and we have over 100 bills in Congress, as you very well know, that address many, many different topics. As far as this algorithmic bias bill, do you think, we've had many members of Congress, Senate come in and say that it's in this year, we can't have a comprehensive AI bill, but we'll have separate things in there. Would you like to see this algorithmic bias bill go through this, or you would want it to be part of a bigger comprehensive AI bill, or it doesn't matter to you?
Yeah, no, I think it's important to think about what the legislation looks like. I think part of what lawmakers are trying to do is they're trying to take pieces of how artificial intelligence impacts society and come up with best practices for that. I do think with the AI Bill of Rights that there is a guiding document that should be applicable in this particular case. But at the same time, there are different ways that we might think about the use of AI, either its benefits or its cons, in terms of thinking about, say, workforce development and the way that algorithms are used to take applications and decide who rises on the list, or in law enforcement, in terms of using facial recognition technology or geofencing, which is a form of technology that, say, if you're having a protest, law enforcement can track people's phones and their social media activity and know who is involved, or hot spot policing, which allows them to look at their maps that allow you to see the prominence of crime that might happen. And in turn, that could lead to over-policing of a particular community. So I think with a lot of the technology, there are some big guiding principles that could be part of a large sweeping legislation. For example, the length of time that people's information that's wrapped up in the algorithms is actually used is important. Another issue is, particularly when we talk about law enforcement, is the steps that should be taken after they recognize someone in facial recognition, then what should happen after that? okay, they should rely on their same standards and trainings. And I'll tell you, this is extremely important because take ChatGPT as just another example, which has been extremely popular. Mm-hmm. I have a study with some colleagues and we were looking at the influence that, say, Black Lives Matter protests have on police reform in cities. It's a question that everybody wants to know the answer to. Did the protests matter? Did they not? And we found that they did in a lot of different ways. It depended on the specific legislation. But what's important is across roughly 90 of the largest cities in the U.S., we took ChatGPT to replicate our human analysis, where we had graduate students at three different universities, University of Maryland, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and now one of my colleagues who is at Washington University. So some great university students doing this work. And we found that ChatGPT could replicate our analysis at about 85%. People hear that and they think, wow, that's really good. ChatGPT can do that. Maybe in the real world, but not really, because in the academic sense, that cannot get published. What we need are standards that get to at least the 0.05 significance level, where we are 95% confident that what we're seeing is correct. Ideally, it would even be at the 0.01 level, 99% correct. We're talking about millions and millions of data points that go into these algorithms. And when we primed ChatGPT, it actually improved. It got up over the 90%. And I say all this to say, from dealing with bias, dealing with diversity, who's included, from dealing with the testing aspect, ensuring that the technology has actually been tested before it's just applied, and then also thinking about the significance and confidence that we have, I think those are things that could be bundled together. Because one thing I know, having a virtual reality training program, you know, you can dangle the new shiny thing in front of people and they're going to want to utilize it, but that doesn't mean they should. And I think that is the responsibility of our lawmakers to ensure that we are treating everyone the same and that we're making sure that when the technology is deployed, that it's not actually doing more harm than good.
So making sure the thresholds are very high, as you said, maybe 95, 99%. And also our lawmakers are making sure that the technology has access to everybody.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
How should we hold organizations accountable if the outcomes are not right for some of these AI applications in these critical areas, whether it's bias or some of these other things? Any suggestions from you?
Yeah, when we start talking about accountability, obviously, depending on which side people fall on, that there are different perspectives about incentives versus sanctions. I think both can be applied. I think that there could be trainings and opportunities for funding for companies to apply for to create these setups for them to be able to test their technology. One thing we have to realize is there isn't a lot of legislation saying that if you create something and people purchase it, that then you have to be extremely held accountable for various things if it's not a product that can harm people. And I think the issue now is, how do we think through the harm that AI technologies might be causing? Of course, we could get into how we think about robots and cars and that extreme part. But if we're talking about VR goggles and what that looks like and the deployment of facial recognition software and eye tracking and all of that, then we have some things to think through. So I think that there could be incentives that could also not just include money up front, but could include tax breaks if companies engage in certain types of behaviors. But then also think that there do need to be some precautions taken and actually some sanctions handed down if companies aren't going about things in a proper way. And I think that becomes extremely important in this current era that we're living in, that as people are trying to make sense of it and understand it. And as an expert, and when you talk to experts, people are worried. And I think that's one big thing I always think about. The people who know the most, when they're worried about where something can go, then you want to be very cautious and you want to approach it in a way that's not going to cause more harm rather than good.
As you said, there are people who are worried and we don't want to cause harm. One of the messages that comes across consistently, and that's why we call it Innovate Responsibly, is how do you continue down this path of innovation, but which our country is famous for, but also strike the balance with responsible development? Any suggestions that you have for our listeners? Because there is always, they say, hey, we need to innovate. We don't want too many roadblocks, etc. And then there are people who say we need to be careful.
I think they go hand in hand. The issue is that we act as if being innovative, that a consequence of innovation is casualty. And oftentimes what people mean is the speed by which it happens. And we do understand, particularly in the U.S. context, that if you're first, typically you're going to get more kudos, even if you're wrong. And I think that we have just culturally, we have to think through that. But I think in a globalized context, it means ensuring that people from different countries, different parts of the world, whether that's India, the Middle East, countries in Africa, countries in Asia, countries in Europe, that we need to ensure that people are sitting at the table. And I will say a lot of the large tech companies have created and are starting to create these broader global policy councils of experts. And I think that smaller companies can do this much quicker. And I'm starting to see that. I mean, I get reached out to on a regular basis from smaller companies saying, hey, would you want to be a consultant? Could you provide some guidance on some of these issues? And I think there are a lot of people who could provide this guidance. So if people are starting up a new company or they've started up and they're trying to get to scale and they're moving really fast, it's nothing for you to create a global advisory council that meets four times a year to provide you with some guidance where every 90 days or so, they're able to come in and say, oh, you just did what? Hold up. Let's think about the consequences of that. Sometimes tech CEOs who are moving or venture capitalists who are just thinking about the money and creating something and selling it, they're not thinking about these other sides of it and the harm that it can cause. But simply creating a council four times a year to pause you to say, hey, these are the big things you need to consider. And more importantly, down the road, if you're going to keep this company or you're going to sell it, these are some of the things that are going to happen if you don't address this issue now. And I think that's why they go together. People perceive innovation is about speed. But as a social scientist who have created a lot of these different types of things, having different people together, sometimes the speed can get you in trouble. Just take a little time to slow down. Make sure that you have the experts around you that can provide you with guidance, and then make the decision that's best, not just for the present, but also for the future.
What you just said, do you worry about either a monopoly or something with some of these tech companies? Because you talked about these smaller companies. It takes a lot today to put together a large language model. Now prices will come down, but these the price, you know, availability of chips, etc. is, and does that have an impact in some of the work that you're doing?
So I do worry about that. I do worry about monopolies. You know, I think that some of the large tech companies, what they do well, they see somebody creating something and they buy that company and then they hire that person. And for that person or those people, that's great. That's the way the game is played. I do think that once we get inside those companies, we do start to see diversity in terms of thought and different cultures. And what's important for these companies to do is to identify the smaller companies and the talent in a diverse way, globally in terms of how we're thinking about it. The second part of your question was what?
It was just that if there is a monopoly, would that have an impact on some of the things that you're doing in any way?
Yeah, most definitely, because it would stymie thought. I do tend to think, I'm not sure if that means that we need legislation to prevent that. I tend to think that we need more opportunities to create opportunities for people to innovate. And I think that's one of the biggest things is that when you look at Silicon Valley, when we look at some of the top computer science and engineering schools, the demographics haven't changed a whole lot. And the way that I think about it, we've had time over the past 20 years to provide opportunities for people in local communities, people who are geniuses, just like people who are at MIT and Stanford and Harvard and the like. And so we need to create those portals and those opportunities. The same way that I'm talking about an advisory council, there could also be a thriving community boards of people who are in local communities who have created an app, who have created something that's happening in their local community, who have all this talent. If they went through an incubator, they could be part of these tech companies or auxiliary to them to actually end up helping to create things that make the world a better place and also create equitable opportunities for people across race and class divides.
Roshan, since you just talk about equity, and I brought this up with many members of Congress and industry leaders, we have a little bit of a, well, I won't know, but we have a digital divide in our country. Do you worry about an AI divide that could even be much worse because this is such a transformative technology? Large universities can afford, Carnegie, Stanford can afford to have large language models. Maybe smaller colleges, community colleges, et cetera, can't afford. And that kind of perpetuates the equity or some of these things that you're talking about.
Most definitely. one of my Brookings colleagues, Dr. Nicole Turner Lee, heads up the Center for Technology and Innovation at Brookings. And we received some funding from Meta to actually explore this exact issue. And part of what we were noticing with the language modeling, with the machine learning processes, is where they were located at and who was excluded from that. You mentioned community colleges. It could also be historically Black colleges and universities, HBCUs, Hispanic-serving institutions, the smaller rural places, similar to how we were talking about law enforcement earlier and which departments have access. Universities fall along that same lines. Okay, so what could be the response to that? The National Science Foundation, other funders coming from the federal government, they could say, in order to give funding, we have to see diversity with your research team. That's one of the things that we're doing at the American Institutes for Research. We want to see diversity of thought. Why do we want to see that? Because research continues to document that the more diverse teams are, the better the innovation, the better the thought process, the better the product, and then ultimately, the more money that the company makes or the organization is actually able to garner. The National Science Foundation, which they've started to do this, they've started to say, okay, we'll fund you at one of these large universities, but we want to see you partnering with people who are at different universities. So Nicole and I, we've convened some stakeholder groups at these universities to talk about what the barriers are. And I'll just say at Morehouse College down in Atlanta, which is an HBCU primarily for Black men, that Morehouse is starting to do this innovation. They are starting to get some of the funding to do this. Bowie State University in Maryland is starting to do the same. Morgan State University has an anime club, and students are starting to innovate in engineering and computer science. So the talent is there. What the second thing these companies could do is they could create pipeline programs. The federal government is starting to fund those. We've seen a lot of pipeline programs over time in the social sciences and health and education. I've been part of several of them with the Ford Foundation, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the like. We need them in those tech spaces as well. And I think that is something that all of a sudden will help to transform the field, where when you're around these students, you just see so much innovation, you see so much geniusness, and they haven't had the ability to actualize that because they've been cut off from resources and they haven't had that opportunity. I mean, look, if you look at most of the heads of a lot of these companies and the founders, you'll see that when from the time they were born, something technological was put in their hands, not just the phone like everybody has now, but the next best thing. Back in the day, it was a computer that all you could do is play Oregon Trail or type letters. That's all they needed to innovate. And so we need to create opportunities for youth to innovate, for students to innovate, and lawmakers can actually create those pipeline programs and also incentivize companies for creating internship opportunities for students at HBCUs, Hispanic-serving institutions, community college, and rural schools to end up having these same opportunities.
Excellent point, because we made that point many times. So lawmakers can and companies can create some internship opportunities for HBCUs, Hispanic-oriented colleges, rural institutions, and community colleges. Rashawn, how does your lab incorporate feedback from end users such as law enforcement officers, military personnel in the development or refinement of some of these training programs?
Yeah, really good question when we talk about end users. For us, it's fundamental, particularly when we were priming the algorithm to make sure that it was as representative as it could be. We set up a series of steps that are really important for people in the tech space because they just don't always do this, but it will be in their research and development and policy shops. They need to incorporate that across their organization. So what we would do is people would go through the technology. We would essentially do an exit interview, ask them a series of questions. We would also ask them a whole bunch of other stuff about policing that was important for us. They would complete a survey. And then sometimes we would even have people come back and repeat and tell us whether or not the algorithm had increased, whether or not there are more responses now, whether or not it's more robust, so that they can actually see how their input is incorporated in. That end part that I just mentioned is so important. If you include people and you ask them their opinion, then you want to have a mechanism by which to show them how you've incorporated their opinion. If in person, virtually, a document that says, hey, these are our takeaway points and this is what we did with your information. That's part of what Nicole and I have been doing with these listening sessions. And we've been putting together public blogs that go out that actually say we met with a group of stakeholders that have been underrepresented and marginalized in this space. Here are the top 3 to 5 things we learned from them. So for us at Laser, and I should mention Dr. Long Doan, who is now heading up Laser, is that part of what we're doing there is getting that end user information to then be recycled back in to better inform the decisions that we're making, to refine our questions, to think about what we're missing, to focus on how to improve it, to provide content back. Because the great thing about our program is that ultimately police officers are using it to train each other. So we want to make sure that it's best informed by law enforcement. We can't have a law enforcement program that's informed by academics and students. That there will just be gaps. There are things that we don't know that they've been trained to do. And that's part of elevating them as subject matter experts. That helps to break down barriers. If you're going to have a program that's going to go into local communities, the people who need to be sitting at the table are the people from these local communities, whether not just in the United States, but as I mentioned, other parts around the world where we know certain technologies have been deployed. And importantly, this collectively all deals with trust, which is something that we've essentially been talking about. Companies have to ensure that people trust their products. Part of trusting their products is ensuring that they've been listened to, that they've been included, that they won't be exploited. And part of that means centering that they're at the table and centering community voices in that perspective and throughout the process to ensure that they've been able to inform the decisions that have been made about technologies.
You have a tremendous feedback loop, getting feedback, giving it back, making it transparent. I think that's a very, very important thing that you mentioned. Roshan, finally, do you see global cooperation opportunities for some of the things that you're doing, whether it's learning from others or others learning from you? Because we live now in a global world, really.
Yeah, most definitely. I think that global element is key. There are consultants and stakeholders that I interact with from around the world. And I think that becomes extremely important in terms of thinking about the decisions that are being made. There are different contexts at play, what we call in sociology, different social contexts that say if you're in Zambia, or if you are in India, or if you are in Ireland, or if you're in Amsterdam and the Netherlands, it all play a different role in what's happening, where people could take the same technology, but the way that it's applied in those different contexts will vary. So ensuring that there are people that I check in with who are part of different teams that I bring into the fold to help inform what's going on. I typically do that in a very specific way, typically at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end, and then on down the road as a follow-up to ensure that we're not missing something. It's like, okay, what did we miss? Who do we have at the table? One luxury that I have being a professor, particularly at a place like University of Maryland, is such a diverse place with people from so many different countries that oftentimes I just have to look across campus and bring in different people who are here as international students, who are immigrants coming in, to be able to sit at the same table and have a unique conversation or put people together virtually. And I think those are the decisions that we made. I mean, if people saw our laser team and the consultants we work with over time, people will say, wow, this is what things should look like. It's, yes, we have such a diverse group of people across race, across gender, ethnicity, nationality, social class, background, ability. That was deliberate. And there are a lot of people who think that you compromise the outcome or you some kind of way compromise success by doing that. I haven't found it at all. I found that these individuals are pretty much some of the brightest and smartest people and hardest working people I've ever been around. The problem is that oftentimes they don't have those opportunities because of people's own individual biases and not necessarily letting them be able to sit at the table to help shape and inform decision making.
A tremendous global coordination happening, and some of it is right in your backyard at University of Maryland. As you said, it's a virtual UN in some ways of people. I've had the pleasure of visiting many times, and I agree with you. Roshan, this has been fabulous. I could go on for hours, and maybe we'll have you back again. But some final remarks for our listeners. As I said, you, the global listeners, what would you like for them to learn, or is there anything that you'd like them to do? We have legislators from around the world listening.
Yeah, look, I think some of the biggest takeaways is that aiming to remove bias and aiming to center equity does not mean compromising on what the product looks like. Instead, doing those things actually makes your product better and builds more trust. It also sets a pathway forward that we have to think not just about the present, but the future. 20, 50, 100 years down the road, when most of us are not here anymore, as these advances in technology continue to speed up for lawmakers, you have to act, because if you don't, then you continue to fall farther behind as these technologies advance so quickly. And it doesn't mean that legislation isn't amended. It doesn't mean that it's not even just completely scrapped and changed. But in the moment, do what's best now by thinking about the future. You can get some of the best minds around to tell you what the technology is going to be in the next 10 to 20 years. Like, I already know that because I've seen it. It just hasn't hit the market yet because the public isn't ready. But the same way that we were developing our virtual reality training program nearly a decade ago, and now these things are becoming a thing, you have to get ahead. You have to use legislation to get ahead of the technology and use research practices by which to guide the accountability mechanism to ensure that these, when these technologies hit the market, that they're doing more good rather than harm.
So get ahead of the technology, do action. I think those are very, very important points because it's not for today, it's also for our future generations. Roshan, this has been tremendous. I learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have learned and would love for you to come back. Thanks for the opportunity and for our listeners to stay engaged because AI regulation matters. Creating a just and fair AI system matters to all of us. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.